All right, so we're diving right in today with a case that really gets you thinking about how contracts play out when, well, when things go sideways. It's Kent State University versus Ford.
Definitely a fascinating one.
And this one really shines a light on the, you know, the money side of these college sports deals, you know, because it involves a basketball coach who took another job.
Absolutely. And for our law students out there, this is a great example, even though we're talking sports.
Yeah.
This deep dive is all about contract law.
Yep.
So we're going to really unpack this, you know, crucial difference between what the courts see as, okay, compensation, you know, when a contract gets broken, and what they say, whoops, that's too far. That's a penalty.
Right. So it's not just about like someone broke the rules, like, you know, you actually have to pay up for the, you know,
exactly
the actual damage.
It's not just about punishment. It's about making things right.
Right.
So we're going to take a really practical look at how these, you know, these concepts, they actually play out in a real world case.
Absolutely. And we've got all the court documents, you know, lined up and some sharp analysis to dig into. Our mission here is to really understand how these liquidated damages clauses, you know, how they get enforced, especially in situations where it's like you can't just, you know, put a dollar amount on the loss.
Right. Because how do you measure, you know, disappointment?
Exactly.
How do you put a price tag on, you know, lost reputation?
Yeah.
So to kick things off, why don't we lay out the timeline? This Kent State versus Ford case.
Yeah.
You know what actually went down that landed them in court?
Yeah, well, it all goes back to 2008. Kent State, they bring on Gene Ford as their, you know, head basketball coach. Pretty standard four-year contract.
Mm-hmm.
But here's what's important for us. You know, it had this liquidated damages clause in it.
Okay.
And basically this said, if Ford decides to, you know, bounce before those 4 years are up, he's going to owe the university whatever's left on his contract, you know, the salary.
Right. Makes sense. Okay. You know, got to protect their investment.
Yeah. And then fast forward to 2010, they're back at the table renegotiating, you know. New five-year deal for Ford. Nice pay bump. He's now making $300,000 a year.
Not bad.
Not bad at all. But here's the thing, that liquidated damages clause, it's still there hanging out in the new contract.
Oh, so they kept that in.
They did. And this, you know, that's really what sets us up for this whole legal showdown.
Right. Because if everything went smoothly, we wouldn't be talking about it.
Exactly. So March 2011 rolls around, not even a year into this new five-year deal, and boom, Ford resigns.
He's out of there.
He's out of there. He's going to Bradley University to be their head coach. Even bigger paycheck, you know. $700,000 a year.
Wow, that's a significant jump.
Huge jump. So Kent State's feeling kind of, you know, like they got the short end of the stick here. They decide to sue Ford, breach of contract, the whole deal, and they're asking for $1.2 million,
which is, you know, not a small chunk of change.
No, it's not. And that number, that represents what Ford would have made, you know, over the remaining 4 years of his contract with Kent State.
So they're saying, hey, you walked away, you owe us what we would have paid you.
Yeah, exactly.
Interesting. So they're going for the full amount. But there's got to be more to it, right? Like, what made the court really zero in on this particular case?
Well, there's this little nugget from that 2010 contract renegotiation. You ready for this?
Yippee.
Ford actually tried to get that liquidated damages clause taken out when they were, you know, hashing out the new terms.
Oh, really? He tried to get rid of it.
He did. He tried. Didn't work, though, obviously.
Yeah.
But that detail, that became a really, you know, crucial bit of evidence for the court. It showed, hey, this wasn't some, you know, hidden clause that Ford was blindsided by.
Right. It wasn't sprung on him at the last minute.
Exactly. He knew it was there. He tried to get rid of it, and he agreed to it in the end.
So that's important.
Yeah.
So we've got the timeline down, but let's get to the heart of the legal issue here.
Mm-hmm.
What was the big question that the court had to answer?
The core question was that $1.2 million figure, was that legit compensation for, you know, Kent State losing their coach? Or was it, you know, like Ford argued, was it basically just a way to punish him for, you know, leaving for a better gig?
Right. And that's a huge difference in the eyes of the law.
Yeah.
Courts really frown upon, you know, using contracts to just punish someone.
Right.
The whole idea is that, you know, a contract gets broken. The remedy, the solution should be about making the, you know, the person who got hurt whole again.
Yeah.
It's about making them, you know, compensating them for what they actually lost.
So not about, you know, making the other person suffer.
Exactly.
It's about making things right.
Right.
Okay. So how did the court figure out if this liquidated damages clause was, you know, fair compensation or if it was a penalty? It sounds like they used this thing called the Sampson sales test.
They did.
Yeah.
Ohio courts in cases like this, they follow this precedent, set in a case called Sampson Sales Incorporated versus Honeywell Incorporated. And they use this specific test to see if a liquidated damages clause is enforceable. Basically, it looks at a few key factors to figure out if the clause is a reasonable guess of, potential damages or if it's an over-the-top penalty.
All right, so let's take the Samson sales test and apply it to our case here, Kent State versus Ford. The first part is the uncertainty of damages. What did the court have to say about that in this situation?
This is where things get really interesting because you're dealing with college sports and the role of a head coach.
Right.
The court gets it. When a big-time basketball coach suddenly leaves, it's like a bomb goes off.
Right.
The financial fallout for the university, it's a mess. It's impossible to predict.
The ripple effect.
It is a ripple effect. You've
Yeah.
got recruiting new players, future ticket sales, alumni donations, the whole morale of the team, how they're going to perform, and even the university's reputation takes a hit.
Yeah, the whole, the brand is tied up in the team.
Yeah, exactly. So the court basically said, trying to put an exact dollar amount on all of that, not just right now, but for the rest of the contract with maybe a new coach, who knows? It's like reading tea leaves.
It's just speculation.
It is pure speculation. It's not like, a business losing a certain amount of sales because a supplier bailed on them.
Right, it's not like a simple equation.
It's way more complex.
Okay, that makes sense. You can't just, point to the books and say, oh, we lost this much because the coach left.
Nope.
What about the second part of the test, the reasonableness or proportionality of the damages that they agreed on?
Right. So here, the court, they really focused on the fact that Gene Ford, well, he wasn't just some average Joe,
Right.
He was what they call a sophisticated party. This isn't some, rookie who got tricked into a bad deal.
Right.
Ford was a hot commodity in the coaching world. And crucially, he had lawyers on his side during those contract talks.
So he was well represented.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So the court's thinking was both sides. They had their experts. They knew what they were doing. They willingly signed this agreement.
So it was a level playing field.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that liquidated damages clause, which was based on his salary at the time, it reflected his market value. It wasn't some crazy, over the top amount considering his job and how much he could potentially earn.
Right. It was in line with what you would expect for a coach at his level.
Yeah.
And then we have the third part of the Samson sales test, which is all about the intent, what the parties intended when they made the deal. What did the court say about that in this case?
Here's where that interesting detail about Ford trying to, ditch the liquidated damages clause during the 2010 renegotiation that really comes back into play.
Right.
The court saw this as like, flashing red lights, basically shouting, hey, both Kent State and Ford, they knew about this clause, they knew what it meant, and they meant for it to be, a real binding part of their agreement. It wasn't some, hidden gotcha that Ford could say, oh, I had no idea.
Right, it was right there in black and white.
It was. And by trying to get rid of it and failing, well, he basically showed that he understood it and accepted it.
Yeah, it's like the court was saying, look, you knew it was there, you tried to get rid of it, you couldn't, so now you got to live with it.
Exactly. And, it's also worth mentioning that the court brought up a similar case, Vanderbilt University versus DiNardo, where courts have often sided with universities when enforcing these types of clauses, when coaches leave.
Right.
This really shows that the legal system gets it. Coaching stability is huge in college sports.
It makes a big difference.
It does. And universities pour a ton of money into their athletic programs and these coaching staffs. So these clauses, they're often seen as a way to protect those investments, keep things a bit more stable.
So it sounds like in this Kent State versus Ford case, the court wasn't, super worried about Kent State proving exactly how much money they lost because Ford left. It was more about whether that liquidated damages clause was valid on its own, based on that Samson sales test.
That's a big takeaway for anyone studying contracts. If a liquidated damages clause passes this kind of test, the person trying to enforce it, they don't usually have to prove the exact amount of money they lost.
Right.
The amount they agreed on in the clause, that's what they get.
So that upfront agreement really matters.
That's crucial.
Now, the court may have ruled for Kent State, but it wasn't a slam dunk decision, was it? There were some, different opinions in there.
Oh, yeah. There were definitely some different perspectives laid out in those concurring and dissenting opinions.
So what did the concurring judge have to say?
So Judge Rice, he agreed with the majority that the liquidated damages clause was, good to go in this specific case.
Okay.
But he did raise a really important point.
What was that?
He said just using the remaining salary, like as the automatic formula for these damages, that could end up being unfair, in other cases.
So it's not a one size fits all kind of thing.
Exactly. He was basically saying courts need to look at these clauses carefully on a case-by-case basis to make sure they're really a genuine estimate of potential losses and not just a way to sneak in a punishment.
So even if you agree with the outcome in this case, you gotta be careful about applying that same logic everywhere.
Right. Context matters.
What about the dissenting judge? What was Judge Cannon's main argument against the majority?
Judge Cannon, well, he went a step further. He flat out said that liquidated damages clause in this contract was a penalty and it shouldn't be enforced.
Wow, so he really disagreed.
He did. His main point was that making Ford pay his whole remaining salary without even considering, you know, did Kent State actually lose that much money, that was just plain unfair.
Okay, I see his point, yeah.
And he asked a very simple but powerful question. Why should Ford have to pay everything if the university might have actually saved money by hiring a, you know, a cheaper coach?
Right. If they found someone, you know, up and coming for less money, they might have even come out ahead. That's a tough question for the majority to answer. It really shows, you know, this tension between wanting to uphold contracts that people agreed to, but also making sure the courts don't let things get, you know, too out of hand.
It's a balancing act for sure.
So we're trying to find that sweet spot between, you know, freedom to contract, but also making sure things are fair.
Yeah, it's not always black and white. And this case really highlights how hard it is to draw that line between a reasonable guess of what damages might be and something that's just straight up punishment.
So the details really matter.
The details are everything.
So for our law students out there, you know, listening in, what are the big lessons they should take away from this Kent State versus Ford case?
Oh, there are some great points here.
Yeah.
Number one, if you ever find yourself drafting one of these liquidated damages clauses, this case screams loud and clear. Make sure you tie that formula for damages to something real, you know.
So something that actually reflects the potential losses.
Exactly. The court here didn't demand proof of actual losses. But if you can show why you chose that specific way to calculate damages, it makes your case way stronger.
So you can show it's not just some random number you pulled out of thin air.
Right. You're not being arbitrary. It's tied to something concrete.
Yeah.
And also, for goodness sake, make it crystal clear that both sides understand the clause and had a chance to negotiate it. You know, remember how Ford tried to get rid of it and couldn't? That was huge for the court.
Right. It showed it was part of the bargaining process.
Exactly. Lesson number two. This case is a classic example of a basic contract law principle. Courts like predictability.
Right.
They want to enforce agreements that people make. And when it's tough to figure out, you know, how much someone actually lost ahead of time, like in this case with this coaching deal, having a well-written liquidated damages clause that's like gold.
It gives everyone some certainty.
It does. It sets clear expectations and it can help you avoid a lot of,
yeah,
you know, messy legal battles down the road.
So it's better to have it and not need it than to, you know, need it and not have it.
Exactly.
And lastly, we saw how important the idea of sophisticated parties was in this case.
Oh, yeah, that was key.
The fact that Ford, you know, he was a high-paid professional, he had lawyers, he knew the game, that really hurt his argument that the clause was unfair.
Right. The court assumes that people at that level, they get it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they understand the contracts they sign.
So it's harder for them to claim they were taken advantage of.
Yeah. So much to think about here. We've looked at how courts analyze these liquidated damages clauses, especially when it's hard to put a price tag on the harm done. You know, and we saw how important things like the negotiation history and the, you know, the experience of the people involved, how much that all matters.
Absolutely. This case is a really good example of how the legal system tries to balance, you know, letting people make their own deals with that idea that remedies and contracts should be about fixing what's broken, not about punishment.
Couldn't have said it better myself.
So to wrap things up, here's something for everyone to ponder. Even when you've got, you know, experienced people involved, people with lawyers who are making these agreements, where exactly is that line? You know, where do liquidated damages clauses, especially ones based on a simple formula like remaining salary, when do they go too far? When do they stop being a fair estimate of potential losses and become a penalty?
It's a question that keeps coming up,
uh-huh.
You know, and it's one that's still being debated in legal circles.
It's definitely something to keep in mind as you're, you know, continuing your legal studies.
For sure. And thanks for diving deep with us today.
Absolutely.